I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. The president of South Korea has lifted the martial law he imposed on the country, bending to political pressure after a tense night in which troops surrounded parliament and lawmakers voted to reject military rule. President Yoon Suk-yeol imposed martial law late Tuesday out of frustration with the opposition. He vowed to eliminate quote-unquote anti-state forces as he struggles against opponents who control parliament and whom he accuses of sympathizing with communist North Korea. Police and military personnel were seen leaving the grounds of parliament following the bipartisan vote to overrule the president. The declaration was formally lifted around 4:30 a.m. Wednesday during a cabinet meeting. The White House said it was pleased Yoon had backed down. A White House spokesperson said, quote, "We are relieved President Yoon has reversed course on his concerning declaration of martial law and respected the National Assembly's vote to end it." Earlier, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Kurt Campbell said the United States was watching events in South Korea with grave concern. Nearly 30,000 troops are stationed in South Korea to guard against the nuclear-armed North. AP correspondent Raphael Waber has more.
This really harks back to South Korea's previous history of dictatorship, which ended in the 1980s. It's unbelievable for many people in the region to see this happening in South Korea again, because the country over the past decades has become such an economic and cultural powerhouse. It's a friendly place which people don't associate with martial law, dictatorship, or soldiers on the streets.
AP correspondent Raphael Waber. This is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden says the end of his administration also marks the beginning of a new relationship between the United States and the African continent. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Luanda, Angola, where Biden is making a historic visit.
This is Joe Biden's first trip to the African continent as president, and also his last. He landed in Angola late Monday for a two-day trip with a packed agenda, as he told President João Lourenço when they met at Luanda's pink-hued presidential palace.
Very proud to be the first American president to visit Angola. And I'm deeply proud of everything we have done together to transform our partnership thus far. There's so much ahead of us, so much we can do.
Biden wraps his visit Wednesday with a trip to the port city of Lobito, where a new U.S.-financed rail line brings raw materials from Africa's interior to this bustling port. Anita Powell, VOA News, Luanda.
Amid violence in Mexico and uncertainty over U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's immigration policies, some migrants say they're considering returning to the countries they fled. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
As Donald Trump's incoming administration plans strict measures for the U.S. southern border, migrants waiting in Mexico for appointments to seek asylum face a difficult decision. Do they press ahead with diminished odds of entering the United States after Trump takes office? Or do they go back to a place they were so desperate to leave? Juliette Moreno, who traveled to Mexico from Venezuela, recently told Reuters it may not be worth waiting in Mexico for a chance at life in the U.S.
I cry every day. I want to go back to my country. I don't want to stay here anymore. I suffer a lot. Men treat us badly and it's hard. They sometimes mistreat us. Sometimes people die.
Sources told Reuters Trump is expected to take a slew of executive actions on his first day in office, which would give federal immigration officers more latitude to arrest people with no criminal records and surge troops to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. Namibia has elected its first female leader as Vice President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah on Tuesday was declared the winner of last week's presidential election as the long-ruling party remains in power. Official results show the 72-year-old won with 57% of the vote. Her ruling SWAPO party has had a 34-year hold on power since independence from apartheid South Africa in 1990. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, December the 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. President Joe Biden continues his visit to Angola today, Wednesday.
To be the first American president to visit Angola, and I'm deeply proud of everything we have done together to transform our partnership thus far. There's so much ahead of us, so much we can do.
The Democratic Republic of Congo announces its intent to sue Rwanda at the African Court of Human Rights and People's Rights. Kenyan banks are urged to employ more people with disabilities. Spain plans to regularize 900,000 undocumented migrants as new arrivals surge. A South Sudan Governance Forum calls for intergovernmental relations, constitution making, and elections. The Brussels Court of Appeals rules that Belgium committed crimes against humanity in Belgian Congo during the colonial period.
They have clear demands of reparation since they are born from a Belgian father and an African woman, Congolese, Rwandese, and Burundese. They want to obtain the Belgian nationality, and for the moment, Belgium refused to give them the nationality.
And a declaration of martial law in South Korea comes as a surprise to Washington. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. On day three of his visit to Angola, U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to tour the Lobito Port Terminal and participate in the Lobito Corridor Trans-Africa Summit today, Wednesday. The president said Tuesday that the end of his administration also marks the beginning of a new relationship between the U.S. and Africa. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Luanda, Angola, where Biden is making a historic visit.
This is Joe Biden's first trip to the African continent as president, and also his last. After a short stop in the tiny island nation of Cabo Verde, he landed in Angola late Monday for a two-day trip with a packed agenda, as he told President João Lourenço when they met at Luanda's pink-hued presidential palace.
Very proud to be the first American president to visit Angola, and I'm deeply proud of everything we have done together to transform our partnership thus far. There's so much ahead of us, so much we can do.
His administration's top Africa advisor told VOA that Biden sees Angola as Exhibit A of a collaborative relationship with Washington. Francis Brown is Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council.
We, the United States, are working with Angola on a few really important things. One is bolstering peace and security in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Another is growing economic opportunities in the region. A third is technological and scientific cooperation.
Biden also toured the nation's slavery museum, where he acknowledged the deep blood ties between Angola and the United States, and he painted an optimistic picture of the future.
Although I don't know exactly what the future will hold, I know the future runs through Angola, through Africa. I mean it sincerely. I'm not kidding.
Human rights horrors are far from a thing of the past, rights groups say. Kate Hickson is Advocacy Director for Africa at Amnesty International USA.
Amnesty has repeatedly documented excessive and lethal force to disrupt peaceful demonstrations. Not only is lethal force used in these demonstrations, but the victims' families do not have recourse to access to justice. We've also seen several repressive laws passed since 2020. Since 2020, it's been illegal to criticize the president. More recently, this year, we've seen two laws approved that further threaten the rights to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and the media.
Brown told VOA that the president always raises these concerns privately.
He never shies away from talking about democracy and human rights issue with counterparts. And I think that's pretty consistent with the way he's been throughout his long career in public service.
Biden wraps his visit Wednesday with a trip to the port city of Lobito, where a new U.S.-financed rail line brings raw materials from Africa's interior to this bustling port. Anita Powell, VOA News, Luanda.
The Democratic Republic of Congo on Tuesday announced its intent to sue Rwanda at the African Court on Human and People's Rights based in Arusha, Tanzania. According to the DRC Deputy Minister of Justice, Samuel Mbemba, the case, which is scheduled for a hearing on February 12, 2025, focuses on allegations of killings, looting, and other violations in the eastern part of the country. Mulengwa Zihindura is the president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in the DRC and a former spokesperson for former President Joseph Kabila. He tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that there is not much to expect from the court.
As always, no matter what decision is taken by the African Court of Justice, it's not going to help anything. The African Court of Justice has no mechanism of enforcing their decision. So as I have told you in the past, the DRC needs to be on the ground fighting. They're not fighting. The government is focused elsewhere where they are trying to change the constitution to keep the actual president in power for good. This is where the problem lies. That's the problem. And I think what they need to do is they need to go back on the ground and fight. And that is the only way they can be able to resolve this issue. But there is no other way around that.
As DRC is suing Rwanda on this issue, they have scheduled a meeting in Angola to resolve the conflict in the Angolan capital of Rwanda. How do you combine the two, the negotiations and the suing?
Well, you know, the negotiations with the Angolan government have been going on for a long time. And again, they are not going to produce anything unless the Congolese government is able to be on the ground and fight back the Rwandan army and all the proxy forces that are sponsored by Rwanda. All this is theatrical, and it's not going to produce anything, absolutely nothing.
Where are the regional bodies like the East African Community, SADC, even the AU, in resolving this perpetual conflict in that region?
Well, it's the same issue. You know, the Congolese government needs to defend its sovereignty. SADC and these other regional organizations are not going to be able to do that. The DRC has to bring something to the table, which is to show that they have the capacity to fight Rwanda. The Rwandan army is organized and it's fighting the Congolese armed forces. The Congolese armed forces are not being supported by the government. And that's where the problem really lies. And the ambitions of the Congolese government to stay in power forever and to change the constitution rather than be on the ground trying to fight to defend our territory against the Rwandans.
Mulengwazi Hidura is the president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in the DRC and a former spokesperson for former President Joseph Kabila. He spoke from Kansas City with my colleague Douglas Mpuga. A Brussels Court of Appeals this week ruled that the Belgian government committed crimes against humanity during colonization for its treatment of Métis or mixed-race children during colonial rule in Belgian Congo, now the Democratic Republic of Congo. The case was brought by five Métis women born in the then colony between 1948 and 1952. Genevieve Kanida is the advocacy and policy officer for African Futures Lab, which has been tackling global racial injustices across Africa and Europe. She tells me that the court ruling highlights the importance of the right to reparations.
I think the first significance is obviously a former, European colonial power being, condemned from crimes against humanity for facts that did happen during the colonization. This is one-of-a-kind trial and ruling here in Europe. So it's very important in a time where European states are trying to, make apologies for colonization, but they do not want to really talk about the reparations, or they want to think about the reparations in certain way. But here we have five women that take their cases to the court, something very big, which is a condemnation for crimes against humanity.
Exactly who are the Métis children?
Okay, so Métis children are, Métis is a French word, but you can translate it by mixed race. But here in French, in Belgium, we say Métis, but it's the same in English. And these children were born during the colonial era from European men and African women and young girls, because they have stayed. And these children were seen at the time as a threat to the colonial order and white supremacy and the so-called hierarchy of the races that was put in place by the colonial power. In that case, Belgium. And because they were seen as threat to the colonial order, these children were taken away and abducted to be put in religious institutions and taken away from their African families.
You mentioned reparation. What is next for the victims after this ruling?
What is next for the after this ruling? I think it's continue the struggle for reparations because I think it's important to distinguish something. We have some children that were abandoned in the Great Lakes region, so DRC, Burundi, and Rwanda after the independence of these countries. And some of these children were taken to Belgium. And Belgium did some work for the mixed race children that were displaced in Belgium. But there is still a lot of work that remains for the mixed race children from the colonization that are still in the former colonies, so DRC, Congo, Burundi, and Rwanda. So the next step is really to advocate for Belgium to also have reparations measures and politics for these people that are still in the Great Lakes region, because they have clear demands of reparation. For example, since they are born from a Belgian father and an African woman, Congolese, Rwandese, and Burundese, they want to obtain the Belgian nationality. And for the moment, Belgium refused to give them the nationality, although they have a Belgian parent father. I think the next step is really that to obtain justice and reparations for the remaining Métis people that are still in the Great Lakes region, the former Belgian colonies.
Genevieve Kanida is the Advocacy and Policy Officer for African Futures Lab, which has been tackling global racial injustices across Africa and Europe. She was speaking with me from Brussels, Belgium. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 4th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Record numbers of migrants have arrived in Spain's Canary Islands from West Africa this year, according to latest government figures. Spain plans to offer visas to hundreds of thousands of undocumented migrants already in the country. As the government says, it needs young workers to boost its economy. Henry Richwell reports.
About 41,425 migrants arrived by boat on Spain's Canary Islands from West Africa between January 1st and November 30th, according to government figures, an all-time record. Most are from Mali, Senegal, and Morocco. Adult migrants are held at camps as they await transfer to the Spanish mainland. Among the residents is 36-year-old Bokar Gueye from Mauritania.
They will give the tickets to everyone, but it is not easy. Everyone will wait their turn. With all the difficulties at sea, I think that the rest, we can be patient.
Spain is bucking the political trend against migration in much of the rest of Europe. Madrid has announced plans to offer visas to 300,000 undocumented migrants every year for the next 3 years, allowing them to stay and find work. Spain needs young workers' taxes to fund the pensions and healthcare of its aging population, according to the Minister for Migration, Elma Saiz.
Spain must choose between being an open and prosperous country or being a closed and poor country, and we have chosen the former. That is why there are already 2.9 million foreigners paying monthly social security contributions.
The visas will only be offered to migrants already in Spain. Simultaneously, Madrid says it is clamping down on new arrivals by striking deals with African states to curb migrant departures and increase offshore patrols. Spain has also called for the EU border agency Frontex to resume operations in the region. But on the Canary Islands, tensions are growing. Spanish residents have staged demonstrations against the high levels of immigration. Protest leader Rudy Royman.
Right now, we don't need immigrants to work. What we need is to give work to the Canaries and to the Spanish in general. We must take care of our land, of our people, of our children, and encourage Canarians and Spaniards to have children. Because if not, what will be left of Spain and the Canary Islands? We will lose our identity.
The migration debate is overshadowed by tragedy. The journey from Africa's Atlantic coast to the Canary Islands remains one of the deadliest routes to Europe. Aid agencies estimate around 1,000 people die every month attempting the crossing. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
In South Sudan, a week-long governance forum has ended with recommendations calling for intergovernmental relations, constitution-making, elections, and for the finance ministry to pay salary arrears and the monthly wages of public servants. Ter Mayang Gatwick is the co-founder and executive director of the Center for Peace and Advocacy, a South Sudan civil society organization which also attended the forum. He tells me that the civil society has an important role in making sure that these recommendations are carried out.
You know, first of all, if you look at the nature of the government, the civil servants, you know, they deserve to be paid at the end of the month. Now, we have the government that does not keep the contract, you know, between its employees. We can never expect, you know, the civil servant working for the government, you know, for a good number of months, and now we're ending the year. And this is a concern. So I think the government of South Sudan has the obligation, you know, to pay all arrears and the salaries.
As you know, South Sudan was supposed to be going to national elections. So you have there a recommendation that the national government should provide the required funding and resources to the National Constitution Review Commission so that it can carry out its work. Do you see a political will for this to be done?
First of all, if the government does not fulfill its obligation, you know, to pay the civil servant, I don't think there will be a miracle, you know, to pay for the National Constitutional Review Commission, because it's one of the requirements in the peace agreement. For the country that South Sudan to hold an election, they need to have a permanent constitution, you know, before going for the election. As we speak now, the National Constitutional Review Commission, even the issue of civic education, is not yet started due to lack of funding from the government. And this is very serious. So the government has to put the commitment so that the donors will come and see and put the resources in place. But lack of the political will, this is what delays everything, you know. Because if you look at the National Constitutional Review Commission, it's supposed to be done during the pre-interim period, you know, when they signed Arafat in 2018. But now we're going to 5 years. I think the issue of political will is going to take us back, you know, because in this country, we have some invisibles. So these invisible people do not want peace, you know, to prevail in the country. They want to continue, they want to live with the confusion so that they can continue like that. And also we have some elements. These are the people who are being sanctioned by the West. For instance, we have some government officials who have been sanctioned by U.S. government and the U.K. government and the European Union. Those people, they do obstruction, you know, on the implementation of the peace agreement.
These recommendations were submitted to the national government. What do you think about their implementation? How were they received?
One of the arguments is that we have the six government forum, the seven, and now the eight. So what happened in the past is why the previous resolution were not implemented, because either there's an issue in the office of the president, or there's a lack of follow-up, you know, to the same state and also to the citizen areas. However, I think it's up to civil society organizations to follow up in order to be implemented by the government.
Ter Mayang Gatwick is a co-founder and executive director of the Center for Peace and Advocacy, a South Sudan civil society organization. He was speaking with me from Juba, South Sudan. As the World Tuesday marks the International Day of Persons with Disabilities, Kenyan banks and financial institutions are being urged to employ more people living with disabilities and invest in programs that cater to their financial needs and services. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenyan banks have improved their accessibility to people living with disabilities by redesigning their entrances for easy access and creating special desks to serve them better, according to the Kenya Bankers Association. Despite the progress made, still more is needed to create financial inclusion for such people in employment. The association's report says only 1% of disabled people is employed in the banking sector. The acting head of the Kenya Bankers Association, Raymond Molenje, calls for the improved employment opportunities for them in the coming years.
So it's a challenge. that we need to intentionally work on this, be able to see within the next year, within the next 2 years, can we move that to 2%, 3%? You know, for government, is actually a target of for the government workforce, every institution ought to be at 5%. So that's government by law. But as private sector, I think we need to even be far ahead of government.
Almost 1 million Kenyans live with some form of disability, according to the country's 2019 census. Seven banks in Kenya participated in a four-month-long project to understand the challenges faced by people with disabilities in accessing financial services in the country. Equity Bank is one of the companies participating in the project. The bank's advisor on diversity, equity and inclusion, Iram Bahawal, said some digital services do not tend to the needs of disabled people.
So some of these apps are not friendly to those with dyslexia. They're not friendly to those with epilepsy. They're not friendly to those with low vision, right? So looking at all this and saying some of these things are quick kills. We just need to tweak some of these back-end codes and it becomes accessible.
Julius Mbora is an advocacy officer from Enable, an organization that empowers people with disabilities. He says such employment can improve the service delivery of banks to disabled people.
Now that they are embracing disability inclusion and bringing persons with disabilities on board as their workforce, they should endeavor to make sure that their assets, internal assets, for platforms, communication, and also their service delivery should be fluid and accommodative of persons with disabilities. Because once you employ a person with a disability, reasonable accommodation is one of the areas you should look at, and to ensure that there is conducive working environment for persons with disabilities.
The Banking Association and other stakeholders in the financial sector moving forward say they will focus on mobile applications, online banking, bank statements, ATMs, social media and employment software applications. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Namibia's ruling SWAPO party was declared winner on Tuesday of last week's disputed election. The announcement ushers in the Southern African country's first woman president after a disputed vote that the main opposition has already said it does not recognize. The election authority announced that Vice President Netumbo Nandi-Ndetwa took just over 57% of ballots, followed by the candidate for the main opposition Independent Patriots for Change, the IPC, with 25.5%. U.S. government officials said they were not notified in advance of the South Korean president's unexpected declaration of martial law, accusing his political opposition of anti-state activities. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman reports from Washington.
Officials in Washington say they were caught by surprise when President Yoon Suk-yeol made a late-night declaration of emergency martial law on Tuesday, vowing to eradicate what he called pro-North Korean forces in his country. Yoon's action was quickly and unanimously rejected by 190 of the 300 members of the National Assembly in a hastily convened midnight session. President Joe Biden, traveling in Angola, was briefed on the situation, according to White House officials. State Department spokesman Vedant Patel told reporters that despite the dramatic development, the alliance with the Republic of Korea remains ironclad.
We are monitoring the situation. We continue to have grave concerns over some of these developments, but ultimately it's our hope and expectation that this is resolved peacefully in accordance with the rule of law.
The United States maintains about 25,000 military personnel in South Korea. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington.